ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our noon presentation. I'm glad that you were all able to make it, and the weather does appear to be improving. I'm Rod Finkel, the president of the council, and I welcome you. I'd like to thank Will Tour, who you can't see, he's sitting over here recording our presentation today. And as you know, that presentation is presented by KSKA on the radio later on during the week. The next program that will be broadcast by KSKA is entitled Addressing Alaskans, and it's last week's presentation presented by Jerrine Mortensen, whose son, of course, is responsible for establishing the girls' schools in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And she was a fascinating speaker, and we certainly enjoyed her. I don't have the exact date it's going to be presented. I thought it was on Wednesday at 9 p.m. in the evening, and Thursday, thank you, at 2. Sitting next to Renee is Flip Todd, who is also a past president and a member of our board, and he will do the honor today in introducing our guest speaker. Flip?
Thank you, Rod. It's my honor today to introduce our speaker, Steve Levine, journalist. Mr. Levine is addressing us as a result of an Alaska Humanities Forum grant on the media. Steve, who is 53, has a long career in journalism, beginning with his assignment to the AP's Charleston, West Virginia Bureau after receiving a master's degree in journalism from Columbia University. He graduated from high school in Ventura County, California, where his father was an engineer at Lockheed's famed Skunk Works that it produced the U-2, the SR-71, and the Stealth Fighter. He is married to, and I'll say this very carefully, Nurilda Nurlia Baeva. Did I do okay? Close, okay. A Kazakh native. My Kazakh is a little weak. They have two daughters at their home in Bethesda, Maryland. In talking to him earlier, it turns out he lives on a street where I delivered the Washington Post for 4 years when I was in junior and senior high school growing up. I live less than a mile away. It's truly a small world. From 1985 to 1988, he covered the Philippines for Newsday, the Long Island newspaper, which attempted to go into New York City and I think and retreated, right? From 1988 to 1991, he was Newsweek's Pakistan correspondent covering that country and Afghanistan. He was later based in Central Asia and the Caucasus for 11 years, starting 2 weeks after the Soviet collapse in 2003. He ran the Wall Street Journal Bureau for an eight-nation region, and prior to that, covered that same area for the New York Times. It is fitting he is addressing us on the media and all its tumult, because he told me a short time ago that last week he was himself a casualty of the cost-cutting going on in the industry. Bloomberg, the new owner of Business Week magazine, long McGraw-Hill's flagship magazine, which I used to write for here in Alaska, laid him off. It's okay, though. He's working on another book to supplement his Putin's Labyrinth, which we show here, and The Oil and the Glory, The Pursuit of Empire and Power on the Caspian Sea. Also, I should mention, we have his book in the back, so anyone who would like to get it, and he'll be glad to sign it for you after the event, please go back and see Lisa back there. Please welcome Steve Levine to the Alaska Humanities Forum's address on the media.
Good afternoon. I'm very glad to be up here in Alaska and to address the World Affairs Council. I wanted to come to Alaska for a long time, and a year or so ago, there was the World Affairs Council annual meeting in Washington, and I begged the Alaska group to bring me up here, and thanks for doing that. I I had planned one talk for today. Usually I talk about oil, and then I was told that the subject of the series is on media, and I had planned a talk on that. And then this morning I even rehearsed it last night before a small group of you over dinner. And then this morning I just rethought. I tore up the whole thing, and decided on giving a whole other talk. And what I thought that would be the most interesting, given the subject, which is the state of the media and the turmoil, is to just go over the world that existed when I was abroad in the former Soviet base, one that I won't say it doesn't exist anymore, but it's on that edge where it's close to not existing. I'm going to be talking about Central Asia and the Caucasus. So most people use the shorthand because they can't remember the name. They call it the stands, and you're allowed to do that. This part here, that's the Central Asia portion, and then the Caucasus portion is right there. Those three states there, and I'm giving you the big picture, so you can see Russia on the top, China to the east, and Iran and Afghanistan to the south, and then just making it a bit bigger, so you can see how it hooks in with the Middle East. So there you are, Central Asia and Caucasus at the top, and then you can see the whole Middle East coming down here, and then finally zooming in close. So how did I get out there? So 1991, 1992, I was based in Pakistan. I was covering Pakistan and Afghanistan. And we meaning the journalists there and the diplomats there and the NGO community heard a lot about what was going on in the Soviet Union at that time, what Gorbachev was carrying out, and we had a certain view of that region that was based on what we were reading at the time, The Great Game by Peter Hopkirk, if anyone here is familiar with that. Eastern Approaches by Fitzroy MacLean, Daring Do diplomat, and we had this very romantic image of Central Asia and wanted to go up there. And at one point, there was a lunch in Islamabad in Pakistan that involved the Pakistan foreign minister, and he announced, it was November 1991, and he announced, we, Pakistan, are going to open up a consulate in Tashkent, the capital of Uzbekistan, and furthermore, we're going to start a weekly plane flight between Islamabad and Tashkent. And until that moment, I didn't realize how close Central Asia was to Pakistan, and I decided on the spot at that moment that I was going to move to Uzbekistan. And in fact, I drove from that lunch to the local Institute of International Studies, and I found a Russian speaker at the institute, and I hired him that day, and I started Russian lessons the next day, and I did really well. By the end of my lessons, I could write the alphabet. So it was one of those times where you could, with a couple thousand dollars, you could say, I'm going to be a correspondent in place X. And in this case, the stars aligned, because I called my editor at Newsweek. I was working for Newsweek at the time. I was kind of a little bit uncomfortable about saying it, but I said, you know what, I'm going to go. I just wanted to let you know, going up to Central Asia, I'm going to take a look around, just a vacation. I'm not trying to to get in on someone else's turf. I'm not interloping. I'm going to just go in it and come out. But if there's anything you guys happen to need while I'm there, just let me know. And And so he said, well, that's a coincidence. We're doing a cover story on Central Asia. Would you like to do Uzbekistan? And so that's how I got in there. That's how I got in. At this time, I'm sure that most people here remember when they were going to, when they were in high school, and there would be a map of the Soviet Union, this huge space and one city, Moscow. Everything else is white or gray, whatever. And that is literally what Central Asia and the Caucasus were when I arrived in January 1992. There had never been a Western, there had never been any foreign journalist based in that region. I opened the very first bureau, Western bureau, in Central Asia and the Caucasus, in Tashkent and in Georgia, in Tbilisi. And the way that happened, this coincided with the fall of Najibullah, the Afghanistan president. A bunch of us were in Kabul at that time, and I had decided, as I've said, to move to Tashkent. And the BBC correspondent, Chris Bowers, who's now a British diplomat, decided he wanted to move to Tashkent. So we did negotiation at the BBC office in Kabul. And Chris said, all right, we'll share an office, we'll share a home with the office in it. This is how we'll split up the duties. I'll pick the dishes, meaning he. I'll pick the dishes, you decide everything else. And that's what happened. So at this time, in Tashkent, in Tbilisi, you couldn't buy a pencil locally. You couldn't buy a chair or a desk. You had to scramble for every single thing. You not only couldn't call abroad, you were lucky if you picked up the phone and there was a dial tone. And so the notion of setting up an office, a Western style office there was truly a grand idea. This is why I think I was able to sell the idea of the office on clients. And so I ended up working for not just Newsweek, but Newsweek, the Financial Times, and the Washington Post. None of them had ever had anyone, of course, outside Moscow, and here they were going to have someone covering these eight republics. The atmosphere was not just one of disorientation, because we just didn't know anything about the place before the World Wide Web, before the internet, before cell phones, but that the locals weren't used to us either. And so you had, for example, in Baku at that time, oil men came in and they were presuming to challenge the right of Russia, of the locals, to have control over their own oil fields. And who do you think was the most interested in their presence? The KGB. And so their rooms, their offices, the oil men's offices, their cars, their homes were bugged all the time. And they were very worried about this, because every oil company on the planet was in Baku, was in Kazakhstan, negotiating, struggling, and fighting for a piece of these oil fields. They bought and brought with them sweepers, these bug sweepers, and they would tell me about this, about sweeping their offices for bugs, removing the bugs, leaving for the evening, and coming back and turning on the sweepers again, and they're all back. During the evening, the KGB would come in and dig holes in the plaster in the walls, stick in the bugs and plaster them over, and it created this very, very paranoid atmosphere, as you might imagine. And BP, as you know, was huge out there, and it is the biggest game in town now on the Baku side. In fact, with its purchase now of Devon, BP will have almost 40% of the share of the offshore. A guy named Terry Adams was in charge of the BP operation at the key moment, and the British ambassador there was Tom Young. And since they were so worried about the bugs in their office, what they would do, and what all the oil guys did, was they would walk along the seashore, and they would presume that because of the waves, because of the rocks, because of the seagulls, that no one could hear what they were saying. So one day, they're in their offices. They decide they have one of these very, very confidential things to talk about. So they, you know, they do one of these gestures, and there they are out on the street, walking down the bayside. And while they're walking down, they notice that behind them a Lada, the local made Lada car, stops, and out jumps a sheepdog. And they notice that as they're walking, when they're speeding up, the dog speeds up. And when they're slowing down, the dog slows down. And whenever they talk, the tail is going up. And they thought, and they actually told me separately, that they presumed that the dog was bugged. And so they left. They stopped their conversation. And of course, this is ridiculous, but they told me this with all conviction. Everyone thought that oil was the big thing. Oil was the only thing. And that the Western oil men were bringing, state of the art techniques to Baku. They were going to take this place, this backwater, and make it into the real world, connect it to the West. And I believed that until I met Fuad Khundov. And I just rewrote this speech this morning, and so I'm trolling the internet trying to find pictures to go along with it. I know this is terrible, but that's Fuad. That's Fuad, okay. So, it even looks bad here. Okay, so Fuad was a policeman with Interpol, lived in Baku. He was 28 years old. And Fuad was a fanatic about Baku history. And he took me on a tour of the city. At this time, I had shifted, and the New York Times had bought out the Financial Times and the Washington Post position. So I was working for them and Newsweek. And I did this story for the New York Times. So Fuad took me around the city and persuaded me very quickly that these Sovietized, grimy buildings that were in front of me actually, almost 100 years before, were the palaces of a whole different generation of people, the barons of Baku, and introduced me to Baku's history, that the first oil capital in the world, the center of oil in the world, was not Pennsylvania, was not Texas, it was Baku. And at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, over 50% of the world's oil came from Baku. And it was a European-style city, and the palaces that he was showing me, these were these extraordinarily wealthy Baku oil barons would go to Europe, and they would come across a palace or a museum or someone, a villa, or they would see a postcard, They would take these home to Baku and have replicas of these built in Baku. Fuad also introduced me to the descendants. There were living descendants, elderly descendants of the barons there. And three of them who he introduced me to were the Asher Bailey sisters, Sarah, who was 90 years old, and Miriam, who was 88, and Adela, who was 82 years old. And they lived in this cramped apartment with six cats. And these cats were very annoying. Hair was all over the apartment, and they fought a lot. But in between they had a fascinating world to describe. And they described their grandfather. And their grandfather was Timur Bek. And he was one of the Baku barons, and how he built and lived in a 70-room palace in old Baku, and how he walked in a sable coat. He died before the Bolsheviks took over, but they described how in the regular mob uprisings that would occur in Baku, how they were once saved. They had a German teacher, they had a French teacher, they had a Russian teacher, and the French teacher who they remembered was a Mademoiselle Grillot, hung a French flag outside of the house and claimed to the mob that it was the French embassy, and the crowd left, and this was just one of those really eye-opening experiences, and I used that quite a bit in the book. One of the other things that you heard a lot in those early days when I got there was that the wars that were breaking out, the uprisings that were breaking out, and other misfortunes, that all of them were caused by the Russians. Now, my first posting abroad was in the Philippines. Philippines, former American colony. When I lived there, I recalled, whenever there was anything bad, like bad weather, accident in the streets, the Filipinos would blame, somehow the Americans were at fault. And so when I would hear this about the Russians, I kind of took it with a grain of salt. I didn't take it seriously. Until in the clue that there was something to this was 1993, a civil war broke out in Georgia. And a few correspondents were hanging out together and doing their reporting together. And one of the reporters, Jan Chensky, who a Pole who was working for UPI, came back from his reporting that day and described how he had come upon a whole field of Russian tanks with Russian soldiers in them. And he interviewed one of them. And he said how did you get here? And he said, well, our commander, based in Suchumi, that's on the coast of Georgia, asked for volunteers. Who wants to go fight in Georgia? And I'm a volunteer. Okay, so this puts some reality to this. And that night, one of the other correspondents and I got a guy working for the Boston Globe, we talked over this and we said, okay, all right, so there's some meat on this bone. And we tried to think, if it's really true and not just localized, that Russia is attempting to reassert control, that it's meddling in these new countries, how would we see that? What would be like just incontrovertible evidence of that? What's something that would be a clue that then we could write a story about, and we decided oil. There would have to be some indication that Russia was trying to take control of something involving the oil, something there. And that was October 1993, and on December 31st, 1993, news came over the wire that Yuri Shafranek, the Russian energy minister, was in Baku, and he had demanded and received a 20% cut in the Baku offshore, and said, I guess Russia is reasserting itself in its backyard, and that started. We wrote that story. I wrote that story for the Financial Times. Financial Times, and that began an incremental process on my part of documenting Russia's reassertion of power through oil in the Caucasus, in Central Asia, deal by deal and country by country. And it became huge, and it after a while, it became an article of faith that this is what was going on geopolitically. And incidentally, that story turned into the American in the late 1990s and recently the American assertion of power in the Caucasus, in Central Asia, on the Caspian Sea. And just to close out that one part, it was very important that someone was there to see that and to document that moment in 1993, and to take that forward. I'm going to tell you now about Aymak Jangaliyev. One of the little known facts about Kazakhstan, just moving beyond the oil, Almaty is the capital. Was the capital. It was shifted. But in the first few years, Almaty was the capital. Almaty in the Kazakh language means father of apples. And so you heard this a lot, people talking about Almaty is the father of apples. And when you went to the market, they had these huge local apple, this big. You hear about this, and finally, my assistant there introduced me to Aymak, and I got here. There he is. Aymak Jangaliyev. I pulled this off of the wall. I wrote this story for the Wall Street Journal. There's no picture of him on the web, but you know they do these drawings. That's why it's a drawing. Okay. So Aymak told me the story about how the world's first apple came from Almaty. They call it the father of apples because there's a Russian scientist way back in the 1920s, Vavilov, who discovered and wrote about his theory that all vegetables and all fruits all originated in some place, and that how this was very, very important for securing the gene pool of these various fruits and vegetables. And he confirmed that the apple that we know came from there. And 90% of the apples that we eat, hold on to your hats, 90% come from two trees. Just two trees. And these two trees way, way back came from Kazakhstan. And in fact, Aymak took me in a Jeep to the exact forest that they came from. And this was what the story that I wrote wasn't just this, gee whiz, okay, so the apples came from Almaty, but that Kazakhstan could save the world apple. And then you sort of wonder, well, why does the world need Kazakh assistance for the apples? And it turns out that because all of these apples, the 90% of the apples, come from just two trees, the diversity of their genes is really, really thin. And they are subject to dozens of apple diseases. And that in different parts of the world, these apple crops are sprayed 10 times a year, 20 times a year, in South Africa 50 times a year to keep the insects off. And that now the repository of US apple knowledge is Cornell University. And scientists from Cornell flew out to Almaty when they heard about all this, and took back with them to Cornell the stems and seeds of the Malus heversi, which is the name of the apple, and tested it. And what they found was that this type of apple, this apple was immune to almost all these diseases, because all of these hundreds and thousands of years when the apples were developing all over the world, in Kazakhstan they had been isolated in the forest, and the genes there kept developing and kept warding off diseases. And so Cornell University at this moment is raising the Malus heversi in order to save the world apple. And IMOC told me all about that, and that was in the Wall Street Journal. IMOC also told me, I forgot to say, at the end there, he said, nothing is more valuable than a gene. The last person I want to tell you about, because what I did was, to do this talk, I went through my old stories, and there are too many of them. So I'm going to tell you one more guy, Daoud Naloyev. I don't have his picture, so you just have to focus on IMOC. So part of my turf, the Caucasus region actually straddles both, crosses over into Russia. And so that was also my turf, the southern part of Russia right there, Chechnya, this war zone, and that whole region, which the war in Chechnya had turned into this very unstable place. And I was down there covering the war, and I ran into Daoud Naloyev. So Daoud was a local parliamentarian who also on the side ran a business selling spare parts for the oil industry. And he is a really remarkable guy, young guy. He had 10 salesmen in the office there. But and he had earned a small fortune doing that. But what he really was pissed off about was the oligarchs. The oligarchs in Moscow, these billionaires who self-entitled and boastful, and mainly that they wouldn't let him into their crowd. And so he set up another business, and what he decided was that after the oligarchs got tired of their yachts and their casinos and their gambling and their women, they were going to seek something that was of fine, of what the fine rich, what the old wealthy do, and that was raising thoroughbreds, earning thoroughbred race horses. Daoud Naloyev had a stable in the middle of this war zone where he had 10 thoroughbred race horses that he had bought from Sheikh Makhdoum, the Dubai defense minister, who was the world's greatest breeder of thoroughbred racehorses. And Daoud drove me out there. It was very scary. This guy drove very, very fast. And so we went out there, went out to his stable, and I saw the horses. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and as he stood there, one of his guys poured from a box sugar into his hand, and he started feeding the horses. It's a war zone. We don't have sugar cubes. And went on to tell me how he was racing these horses, and that sooner or later, these nouveau riche, the oligarchs in Moscow, they were going to come to him, and they were going to want to buy those racehorses, And then he said, I'm going to make them buy my spare parts. Thank you very much.
Now, as a representative of international Western American media, you were able to sort of colonize this area in sort of an entrepreneurial spirit. Would such a thing be possible nowadays, given the basic structure of the market?
I'm glad you asked that. That's actually my point. That one thing I wanted to get across there is that I could and did say, you know what? I don't have anything to do this week. I'm gonna go wander around Chechnya. And what story are you gonna do? I don't know. See what I come back with. And you know, this was underwritten by, you know, these folks who I worked for, who incidentally also split the bill for the two offices that I had, that I ran, the stringers who I had in every one of the republics, all of the expenses for being out there, plus paying per story for me to be out there. In 1996, the Taliban came to power. 1997, I decided that there was this rumor out there that how did the Taliban come to power? That the CIA paid for it, the Saudis gave the equipment, and the Pakistanis did the training without any facts backing these up. And I told Newsweek, I want to go see whether that's true. Okay, I spent 2 months on their dime, wandering around Afghanistan and Pakistan, doing that story, and they spent $25,000 in expenses, and that story ran in Newsweek. Then it ran in another version of it ran in the New York Times. It was part of a package that I wrote, that story with John Burns that won the Pulitzer Prize, 1997. It's also a version of it is in this book. And you know, you just wondered today. I know because you know, even being on staff, you cannot say, I just want to go wander around. I want to go take a look.
Yeah. Next question. There's a question over here. Yeah.
Thanks. I had some oil and gas questions about Turkmenistan, but I'll switch over to media.
You can ask about that.
But I was kind of thinking in terms of media attention to the region with the next Winter Games, Olympic Games, coming to Sochi, which is right there, just... I think a handful of miles north of the Georgian border, whether that would bring kind of increased interest in the region?
Yeah, Yeah, the short answer is yes. I thought you were going somewhere else with that.
I was thinking in terms of with the Beijing Games, I think there was some heightened interest in China and their human rights record and kind of an attempt to link the games and kind of repoliticize games like that seemed to occur a lot in the 80s, you know, in the Cold War era.
Yeah, I guess what I think is that, yes, there will be heightened interest. Will it be highlighted? Where it'll, you know, the stories I think will say, the coverage will say that it's in Russia. You know, will it somehow, be communicated that actually that's in this turbulent zone? I kind of doubt that. I doubt that. But one thing that's going to be a security nightmare. You know, it's right there in the Northern Caucasus. It's next door to these, you know, four or five regions, you know, that are very troubled right now. Ingushetia, Chechnya, and all that. That could come up. Yeah. Yes, sir.
I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about what's the present situation in that region, and where is that region moving to? As far as what can you foresee happening in that region in terms of economy, politics, and things like that?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. The region is I call it a region, but if you're talking in the big picture that way, it's two regions. The European side. Is really one way, and then the other side, the Central Asia side, is another. A key moment, August 2008, and the Russian-Georgian War. This 5-day war changed the complexion of the region. Until that moment, there was this feeling in the air and the presumption that the pipeline, the oil pipeline that the United States had gotten behind that connects the Caspian Sea and the Mediterranean, the Baku-Jehan pipeline, that it had connected that region to the West and given it Western protection, and that there was a balance of power between the West, let's say the U.S. and Russia there. That war put the kibosh on that and put reality into it. And what did it say? It told the locals, "You think you're under the protective umbrella of the U.S.? Think again." And it told the West, "You think that this is your region? Think again. It's not." And so that's one thing. That's one thing that. Russia has reasserted its power there, and to one degree or another, there's acceptance of that, but I think that means that a few things. One, it's not going to become more westernized, and two, there could be more instability there because of that. On the Central Asia side, the direction of events is China. So a few months ago, a new natural gas pipeline came online, and it connects Turkmenistan to China. This was a huge event. When you build infrastructure, you put facts on the ground, and it is it's equivalent to putting like meat on a spit. You connect that region to another place. And that was Gazprom's playing ground. Gazprom has had Turkmenistan on a pendulum, on a string since 1992, you know, since the breakup. And a total monopoly, 100% monopoly, it has isolated it from the rest of the world. Kazakhstan has been unable to export a single cubic meter of its natural gas because of this policy. that changed everything. Suddenly, Gazprom Russia is not the only game in town. China is there. These countries, Turkmenistan, can now export its gas to China. And the next thing that's happening, Iran. Iran is building another, it has a small one, but it's building another natural gas pipeline connecting Turkmenistan to it, to Iran, going south. And Azerbaijan is talking about doing the same thing. And this will change the complexion. But it changes it in a way we did not expect, that the U.S. did not expect. It connects the region to other countries that we, you know, in the case of Iran, we don't regard as a friend. And in the case of China, you know, I think it's somewhere, you know, where is it along that spectrum?
Thank you. It was very interesting presentation. And I have a two-part question. One, the Black Sea is very interestingly situated there. And vis-a-vis that, with the latest developments in Ukraine, can you do your assessment on that election? And the second part is, how does all of this fabulously interesting information could be useful to Alaskan companies?
Let me start with the first question. I don't cover Ukraine. I've never lived in Ukraine. And I talk about places that I've lived in. The only thing that I can say about Ukraine is that I didn't regard I think the election was misportrayed as somehow that Yulia Tymoshenko was a pro-Western figure and was going to bring Ukraine closer to Europe, and Yanukovych was the pro-Moscow guy and therefore anti-Western. I think that whoever won, Yanukovych, as you know, won, and then asserted his power and ousted, had Tymoshenko ousted as prime minister. I think they would have done very similar things. I don't think one was, you know, maybe incrementally one was more close, was closer to Moscow than the other, but I think basically it's the same thing. And as you've seen, Yanukovych is trying to make peace with Moscow right now and taking, you know, extremely concessionary steps to make that work. That's as far as I'll go on that. But you've read all that in the newspaper. Alaska, you know, all I can say is not necessarily on this. I was very interested in last night over dinner, the remarks that Ted Stevens made last week were discussed. And I've been very interested. I've been watching the ramifications of the so-called revolution in the shale gas fields in the lower 48, and how that, the implications of that all around the world. And one reason that I'm watching that is not just because of the U.S., but because of my interest in Russia. Russia built Gazprom, opened an office in Houston to sell natural gas from Shtokman, a big natural gas field. They were going to turn that into LNG, and they're going to they want to capture 10% of the U.S. Gas market. This was just postponed. It's been postponed, this project, for 3 years because of the shale gas. This shale gas, the LNG, it just shows how one thing leads to the other. So LNG from the Middle East, from Qatar, had been intended for the U.S. market. The shale gas has displaced that has pushed that LNG into the European market, which is Gazprom's main market. So Gazprom suddenly has no place to sell that, well, it should say, has less of a market than it expected for that gas. And Shtokman was meant as I was saying, to feed that Houston office for the LNG, and now that LNG isn't needed because of the shale gas. So Gazprom is, it's really up in the air. The balls are thrown in the air. I think a lot about that. What will happen? What does that mean about Russia? What does that mean about Gazprom? And just taking that same situation here, I had been thinking about how the shale gas. I had posed the question to my editors: does the shale gas strand Alaskan natural gas? Isn't that a story that the whole thing about building the Sarah Palin pipeline and the is that okay that I say that? And Denali down to someone shaking their head. Denali down, for the Alaskan gas, that's off. It's potentially off the table, and so I was fascinated. I had not thought about that. Alaska could build an LNG terminal and ship its gas into Asia, and especially to China. And I emailed one of my BP friends who's here working on this whole project, and he says, "No, it's not true, and we're still going to build the pipeline." And I think he's as they say, speaking his own book. This is what brokers say on Wall Street. So that was interesting for me. The Ted Stevens remarks.
I have a question about just your personal journey, and I was thinking about the students in the room too. I'm wondering, how old were you when you first went and decided you were going to
move?
Good. Amazing. Yeah. And also just like, was it scary? As the first Western journalism office to be opened, were you ever targeted by the KGB, or did you, what was it like being over there?
Yeah, we presumed not on the Caucasus side, but there's I don't know, we just never thought about that. But on the Central Asia side in Tashkent, I was expelled from Uzbekistan 2 years after I got there and shifted up to Almaty, to Kazakhstan, and we presumed that the office in Tashkent was bugged. And one of our translators came back once. I did not speak a word of Russian, by the way, when I arrived and learned it while I was there. But one of our translators came back one day. The KGB had summoned him to their offices and asked him a number of questions regarding a story we were working on at that time, and asked him to spy on us effectively. Once a week you will come to this office and tell us, keep track of who your guys have met with and what was said and all that. And he said that he wouldn't do it. And the response was, if you don't do it, we're going to turn you into a wet spot. Mokri mesta. This is a Russian expression, apparently. If someone really wants to do you harm, they threaten to turn you into a wet spot. Just FYI. I don't know. I think people who are in those environments, you're in the moment. I don't think you get scared at the time or pay that much attention to what you're doing. It's after it's all over and after you're here on safe ground, you start thinking, why did I do that? And I really shouldn't have done that. And I'm not doing it again, definitely. Yeah. Thanks. Thank you.
Next Friday, we have Barbara Slavin, who will be our speaker, and it promises to be exciting. And I hope to see you all then. Thank you.